Today on Against the Grain. Modern art has always been a battleground, and the highly influential Museum of Modern Art has been partisan since its inception. Architectural historian Patricio Del Real discusses two differing political visions of modernism and modern architecture, one rooted in the left and associated with figures such as communist muralist Diego Rivera, and the other on the right, represented by the architect and fascist sympathizer Philip Johnson. He weighs in on the role of MoMA in promoting a view of modernism in Latin America, stripped of its radical politics and racial fusions, and radiating American power and hegemony. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. By any measure, the Museum of Modern Art is one of the premier cultural institutions in the world, and MoMA has played an outsized role in promulgating a view of Latin American art and architecture in alignment with U.S. political and cultural interests. The museum, which was established by a trio of women in 1929, including Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, rapidly made its mark on cultural production in the Southern Hemisphere, a story which is explored in the book Constructing Latin America, Architecture, Politics, and Race at the Museum of Modern Art. Its author, Patricio Del Real, is Associate Professor of History of Art and Architecture at Harvard and has himself worked for the Department of Architecture and Design at the Museum of Modern Art. Patricio, how significant is the ability of New York's Museum of Modern Art to influence cultural production far beyond the borders of the United States?
That's a very important question, and it's something that one kind of confronts. The Museum of Modern Art has had for a very long time in the construction of modern culture beyond its geographical limits, let's say, certainly in the United States, but also in New York. One can imagine, why a local institution and a local, private institution has had the ability to project not only nationally across the United States, but also internationally, and certainly the impact that it has had in Latin America. This reminds me of a letter in the archive of when MoMA was opening, I forget exactly which exhibition, in Mexico City. Diego Rivera, who's the famed Mexican muralist painter, was basically arguing that this was just another tool of cultural imperialism, connected to Washington and to Wall Street. So that kind of resonances of the activities of the museum, beyond the national confines of the United States, has always been seen with suspicion, particularly in Latin America, because of the very complex political and economic histories that the region has with the United States. There was always that cloud, if you will, when we were moving across sort of the region, and also because after the whole all the revelations, right, of the connections between different Washington institutions and the cultural politics of MoMA, but also of other cultural institutions in the United States, of course, people see these kind of projections with ambivalence and also with distrust. But of course, one has to historicize this, right? There's differences between the museum projecting during the early post-war or during the war, and museum projections itself globally nowadays, right? Where the the cultural arena, the cultural market is much more competitive than before.
So in 1932, the Museum of Modern Art's Department of Architecture and Design launched a path-breaking exhibition of the international style. Can you remind us what the international style of architecture was and its significance for the projection of a particular cultural politics and U.S. politics onto the wider world?
So in 1932, the museum sort of produces this exhibition, which actually the exhibition was called Modern Architecture International Exhibition, which travel across the United States quite widely. And then concurrent with the exhibition, Henry Russell Hitchcock, who was one of the former architecture historians at the time, along with Philip Johnson, who was a very, very young curator-to-be, let's put it that way, and cultural entrepreneur, they produce this book called The International Style. It's a longer title, but the key is International Style. So the idea of the International Style lived much longer than the exhibition. So the life of the International Style as a book is always intertwined with this MoMA exhibition. So the idea was to present to the U.S. public sort of the latest sort of advancements in modern architecture in Europe by sort of decoding a formal language, right, of the use of particular materials, basically modern material, what's called traditional, like core modern materials, which would be steel, reinforced concrete, and glass, that would allow us, or architects, modern architects, to produce a new kind of space, an open space that could connect interiors and exteriors, that could eradicate all references to history, so the historical styles, like you know, classical styles or the Gothic styles, they were also erased, and it would produce its own, let's see, aesthetics of pure forms, new types of decoration that were not inspired by history. So the decoration will be on the material itself, or the way technology was sort of crafted to produce these kind of new modern sort of objects that embodied a new ways of seeing, but also new ways of experiencing sort of the world and experiencing modernity. So what the International Style then did, it focused on key sort of architects or architect genius like Le Corbusier, Mies van der Rohe, J.P.P. Oot, and others, to actually present them as a style, but in the notion of a language of forms that was synthetic and unitary to build a modern world. Now, what many have argued is that what the International Style and the Modern Architecture exhibition at MoMA, so in 1933, what MoMA did, or Johnson and Hitchcock did, was to eliminate all the political and social grounds of the development of this architecture, or what you could call it, modern architecture, right? So evacuate or take away all its politics, which has to do with social housing, with work, housing for workers. So it has a lot of social content, and it also was kind of connected to the Russian, what was happening in the Soviet Union at the time, you know, in the modern architecture of the Soviet Union. So these kind of new attempts to industrialize countries, and they just presented it as sort of reduced styled with no social significance. Now we can counter that proposition. I would like to counter that proposition is that it's not necessarily that when this architecture that was produced in Europe in a particular social and economic situation was presented in the United States, when it gets represented in the United States, it is precisely the, if you will, the taking away of its political grounds, right, to present it as a elite project that becomes a new way of politicizing the international style. So the supposed, you know, erasure of the social grounds, particularly in Germany, where social issues were very, you know, very, very importantly addressed by this type of architecture, by representing the United States, that kind of erasure of politics becomes a political project. So that's part of the complexities of sort of this kind of new ways of shaping the experience of modernity. In different countries, in this case, in the United States, which is basically what the international style and the Museum of Modern Art is trying to do, and precisely at this moment in time, because both the book and the exhibition give birth to the Department of Architecture, which later will be the Department of Architecture and Design at MoMA, and then all the projects to keep proselytizing this type of vision of the world. If one examines from in the 30s, it is an elite project, because I mean, let's face it, who in 1932 has the ability, right, to build for themselves a house, right? So it is incredibly an elite project, right? So as you know, as MoMA is opening the 1932 show, Modern Architecture in the Rockefeller and in Midtown, right? There are shanty towns in Central Park. And Hoovervilles in Central Park. So I think one has to repoliticize, right, the activities of the museum in the United States, and not simply say, well, they're just borrowing something and erasing, you know, the politics, the European politics, when in fact, by just reinserting it within the context of the United States, it's already a political act.
So then would you say, when we're talking about modernism, including modernist architecture, we have to think of that term as being contested ground, that there is a radical tradition within modernism, and then the kind of modernism that the Museum of Modern Art embraces is a version that in many ways is, by stripping away all this radical history, becomes in some sense a sort of stand-in to the power of transnational capital and the projection of power of the U.S. government?
I think in the 30s, in the beginning, it's still very much a gamble, right? And there are many sources one could see in the 30s, you know, who is building modern architecture, right? For example, we take the work in Germany, which is very much supported by local governments, right, by city governments, to try to improve the lives of the working class.
Right, so you're talking about pre-Hitler, pre-Nazis.
Yeah, we're talking about pre-Hitler. So from the 20s, for example, we can take the work of that is done in Frankfurt in 27. Or, for example, if we take the modernist villas by Le Corbusier, which is also in the 20s, which are, you know, very much products of the elite, right? So there are many sources that are actually fomenting the creation of new works of modern architecture. So it's how we assemble those examples within the narrative, right? That becomes sort of a part of a cultural project, which is underpinned by a political outlook on the world. So when that emerges or travels, let's say, to the United States, that takes a life of its own, right? But it's also a life, I would say, that it's not only within the frames of, you know, of the grand frames of politics, right? Within the Depression, for example, you know, and the social upheavals are occurring in the United States. I mean, serious social upheavals are happening in the United States, but it also has to do with the institutional survival of a Department of Architecture within a very young Museum of Modern Art that is like, it is a project, you know, launched by three women in the midst of the Depression. So there is, you know, the whole considerations of will this project survive. So there's a lot of grand, large-scale politics, if you will, but also localized or micro-politics within the institution itself that are all sort of contesting and negotiating and trying to define what a modern culture in the United States is. From a very particular location like New York, there are many other projects. And what is also fascinating is when this kind of project at MoMA keeps growing and MoMA keeps proselytizing this view, how architectural culture, in this case, will react in favor or against this, right, in relation to the very multiple cultural centers that this country has. And this is actually quite a fascinating sort of story itself, right? It's not, I just focus on the Museum of Modern Art, but there are other cultural centers, you know, producing its own views of what modern culture should be in the United States.
I'm speaking with architectural historian Patricio de Real, author of Constructing Latin America, Architecture, Politics, and Race at the Museum of Modern Art. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you've been describing the setting in which the Museum of Modern Art in the early 1930s, not long, in fact, after the museum was founded in 1929, partially by one of the matrons of the Rockefeller family. You've been describing how the Museum of Modern Art started shaping actively a notion of modern art and architecture well beyond the borders of the U.S. And I wanted to ask you how we should understand the convergence of interests of national governments and local elites and the Museum of Modern Art in perpetuating certain ideas about Latin America through its architecture and cultural production.
So yeah, so the book tries to do is to tell the story of this idea of Latin America. I want to start by saying that, you know, Latin America is not a country, it's not a nation, right? It's this kind of fussy geocultural place or geography that is constantly being used. It's almost also kind of a common sense definition, right? You say Latin America and everybody goes, oh yeah, of course, Latin America. What the book then tries to do is to examine the emergence of this notion, how it consolidates, right? From the 30s to 1955, when in 1955 there was this very important show called Latin American Architecture since 1945. So, and this kind of crystallizes this notion of a supposedly Latin American sort of architecture, as if that thing kind of exists in reality, and you can go to Latin America and see, oh yes, this is Latin American architecture, right? As a kind of this essentialist kind of character of the region. So what the book does, then it dives into the archive and starts to sort of tell this story of how this kind of category is shaped and reshaped, how it collapses, how it comes back through a series of projects, principally through architecture exhibitions, right? And it kind of assembles these to create this, to make manifest this this category. And one can see that there is a level of kind of contingency, of historical contingency, of possibilities that start to emerge because, for example, in 1939, Brazil opens a national pavilion in the New York World's Fair that becomes kind of a sensation in architectural terms, right? Because it actually continues a formal language of modernism that is sort of underpinned by a particular European architect, Le Corbusier, but it really reinterprets it and actually addresses many of the concerns that architects had at the time about this kind of forms or this kind of language of modern architecture, and makes it much more vibrant, much happier, if you will. It becomes this kind of vibrant, dynamic modernism that really speaks to a future of architecture at a time when, you know, the world is kind of collapsing because, you know, we will enter into the Second World War immediately. So this kind of revelation starts to shift sort of the narrative of what architectural modernism, which has been centered, of course, in the United States, in the United States itself, and Europe, and suddenly this new country, you know, South, in the South, kind of emerges as a revelation. This has to do with the cultural politics of the Brazilian government at the time, which is the regime of Getúlio Vargas, who was a dictator, you know, in kind of changing, right, the perception of Brazil as a tropical nation, as a nation that is not modern, that is not industrial. So there's a very clear attempt, constructed attempt to create these particular images, right, of modernity and of, if you will say, and of a agreeable nation to court the political, but also very important, the financial interests of the United States. At this moment, Vargas and the Brazilian government wants very desperately to create or to establish a foundry, a steel foundry that is able to produce high structural steel, which Brazil doesn't have. So he's courting the United States, but he's also courting Nazi Germany, right, to be able to have these kind of technological transfers, to be able to build a steel mill that eventually will actually be the Volta Redonda steel mill that was actually produced in conjunction with the United States, and that was part of the deal. So all this is happening at the same time. So there's no coincidence, right, that when Brazil presents itself in New York, it is a steel building, right, of a technology, right, that is produced in the United States, because it is actually high-grade structural steel, right, but within the language of Brazilian, a new modernism, which we call now Brazilian sort of modernism. So all of these kind of political, social, and economic intersections and nation-building intersections, right, one can actually reveal by exploring sort of how modern architecture is a means to, an actual means to economic and technological development, but also a means to create a symbolic practice and a symbolic condition of Brazil as a unified nation, which was part also of the Vargas government's policies, right, to bring all the different states and all the different regional cultures under one national culture that will become, you know, in architecture, will certainly become this type of Brazilian modernism that we will actually see consolidated in 1960, right, with the capital city of Brasilia, which are, by the way, the two same architects, Lúcio Costa and Oscar Niemeyer, who actually did the pavilion in 1939. So you see this very long, this kind of long durée sort of trajectory of architecture, but also of cultural politics.
Well, and then what's the relationship between modernist architecture on the terrain of Latin America and race, especially a notion of whiteness in a place like Brazil or Mexico?
So what the book tries to do is also to sort of argue for the intertwining of race, gender, and politics in the construction of these kind of cultural imaginaries through modern architecture, right? That we cannot really speak any longer about our architectural modernism without the considerations of race, the considerations of gender, and the consideration of politics, right? That these kind of forms are symbolically, but also socially charged, right, by these pressing concerns and these social structures. So it is I would argue, the book tries to argue, is it's more than just the symbolism, right, of works, right? Because in the end, you know, it's not any essential reading. It's not like a column can be racialized in its own, in its, by its materiality, right? These are processes of, these are discursive practices that appear, you know, through writings, through photographs, through arguments, but beyond kind of the symbolic construction, if you will, there's also the actual processes of spatial segregation, right, that allow, or that architecture kind of produces, replicating social segregations, right? For example, in Brazil, and this is something that was kind of argued or pinpointed at the time, a critique of Brazilian sort of modernism was how Brazilian architects still reproduce, right, a segregated environment by that was the inheritance of slavery, by producing two types of circulations, one for the owners of apartments, for the, and the others for the service. And, you know, this was pointed out already in the 1940s as people were looking at Brazilian architecture. So part of what the book tries to do is actually to recover those moments and to see how not they were only present at the time, but also how they were actually erased and purposely erased so that we, so that to create this kind of universal notion of modern, of modernism, of modern architecture, which in fact, this kind of universalizing culture presupposes a white, heteronormative, male subject, right? And so it, so whiteness, if you will, becomes invisible, but it's still there operating, because also within the whole processes of modernization or modernity, if you will, and many scholars have argued this, right, is they're just ciphers for cultural whiteness. But what the book also tries to do is how to articulate, I guess, in the case of Brazil, how to understand also that these processes, right, these racializing processes are happening in different parts of the world at the same time, and that Brazil has its own dynamics of racialization, right? And how architecture also participates in that. And it's not, we cannot simply use concepts or cultural patterns that are developed in the United States or cultural theories that are developed in the United States and simply apply them to Latin America, because the processes are simply different. You know, the cultural and racial dynamics in Brazil are not the same as that in as those in the United States, and certainly sort of in Mexico. In Mexico, it becomes very, very clear the level of sort of transformation, but also appropriation of indigenousness, if you will, by the central state. In the cultural projection and cultural construction of Mexico, if one goes to the National University, for example, and sees how the articulation of, you know, of ancient traditions, there are multiple and incredibly diverse, get reduced to kind of one state-sponsored cultural project that is embodied, I mean, literally embodied, and you know, a lot of money went into these projects to create this kind of image of a modern Mexico that supposedly pays attention to its not just colonial past, but also to its indigenous past.
Indeed, and in Mexico, it's very striking how Mexican nationalism, as put forward by the state, is deeply tied up with a sort of notion of the indigenous. I should say that this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm speaking with Patricio Del Real. He is the author of Constructing Latin America, Architecture, Politics, and Race at the Museum of Modern Art. That's published by Yale University Press at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. He's Associate Professor of History of Art and Architecture at Harvard. And we're discussing the history of New York's Museum of Modern Art as a cultural weapon in Latin America in the interwar period and during the Cold War. Well, staying with Mexico, You mentioned the Mexican communist artist Diego Rivera, who had a small exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in the early 1930s. I wonder if you could describe for us Rivera's relationship to modernism and even modernist architecture, as he had a kind of different kind of Pan-Americanism than that was being projected partially through the Museum of Modern Art, which was socialist or communist in nature.
Absolutely. And what's kind of fascinating is that when we talk about Pan-Americanism, we have to be very careful on where are we located? Where is this Pan-Americanism located? Because generally, Pan-Americanism, which one must differentiate from what scholars have called hemispheric thinking, right? Pan-Americanism is just primarily a tool of U.S. politics that is actually projected towards Latin America, and there are many sources of Pan-Americanism or the unity of the hemisphere, if you will. And at this moment in time, in the early 1930s, what I find very fascinating is that Diego Rivera is actually proposing his own version of this kind of continental unity. A version that is very much based on his artistic practice and his artistic foundations and sources. So his sources are the ancient civilizations, certainly of Mexico, and indigenous craft. So he's actually during his time and this very difficult times of the Depression, he's starting to imagine. He proposes this kind of unity or union, principally between Mexico and the United States, that he would want to project to the entire Latin America, but that's a different story. About this thing that we could call, barring other prepositions, call this kind of Greater America, right? Where he identifies, I think, the very real and material and objective relationships of the historic but also economic relationships between the two countries. And he then argues, how can these two countries kind of come together, right, as the industrial north, an industrial north powerhouse, right, and an agricultural south, to create a truly sort of American, in this case, America's, not U.S., culture. And at this moment in time, which is perhaps it's brief, but it has been forgotten by the scholarship, he is very much intended in using modern architecture as part and as a mechanism to actually create this kind of fusion between the industrial north and the agricultural south, through the new technologies of reinforced concrete, but also, and we have to also remember that this is a way of being in the world, of inhabiting the world, that has to do with a particular kind of subjectivity, a subjectivity that accepts industrial change, but it's one, in the view from Rivera, that accepts both conditions, in the changes introduced by technology, but also the kind of traditions that are still very much present, right, and active in modernity, right, of crafts that he then wants to kind of bring together. So what we're talking here is not really about modernity and tradition, but of two ways of understanding modernity. One, technological modernity, or if you want, high technological modernity, and the other one, a localized technologies of craft that he kind of brings together. And what is actually fascinating for me as an architectural historian, right, is how he then brings this to an actual way of living or an actual production in the houses that the architect and also muralist Juan O'Gorman did with and for him and Frida Kahlo, which are in Mexico City. And this kind of becomes sort of they are performing and embodying this notion of sort of a greater America, if you will, by engaging and fomenting reinforced concrete construction, but for example also using the petate mats, for example, or crafted furnitures to furnishing the house. So this kind of a hybrid cultural living, if you will. This kind of one can also call this kind of mestizo modernity that takes, you know, from all sources of a modern life and merge them together in a way of living. In a way, of course, that is very important to understand. Also, is it is an aesthetic project. It's not simply a collection of anything goes. It is sort of an aesthetic eye, an aesthetic way of living in modernity that he's actually doing in Mexico City. And then this is at the time that he's actually then also being invited to the United States to produce the great frescoes that he's being produced, this comes, of course, to a whole collision moment in the Rockefeller Center fresco that where he paints Lenin in it. And then basically he's paid for his services in full, and the fresco then is destroyed. The first act of artistic or cultural vandalism, one of the first of Western cultural vandalism, at least in New York. And then it is replaced with Josep Maria Sert, who's actually quite a conservative painter.
And of course, that story of the destruction of Diego Rivera's mural brings us to the Rockefeller family, who are crucial in the story of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, both to the founding of it and the fortunes of the museum. So let me ask you about the importance of the Rockefellers to this history.
So yes, we certainly should not forget the incredible influence that the Rockefeller family has had across the years at MoMA. But also I want to underscore that this was the project of three women. Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, a very important character in the story of MoMA, but also Lily Bliss and Mary Sullivan. So, you know, so it's important not to forget that it is three women who are leading this charge to create a modern art museum during sort of the Depression. So this kind of agency and the ability and the force that these three great characters have in the institution itself. What is interesting, I think, also is that then each one of these characters brings a particular sort of thrust, an interest, right, to the Museum of Modern Art, and it is how these kind of interests are negotiated and battled and actualized that becomes, you know, a fascinating story that, of course, is beyond what I'm trying to tell in this book. What I kind of argue, and this is quite clear through the history of the museum, is that the Rockefeller interests in the museum intersect that of Latin America, or their own interest in Latin America, because of the great sort of economic interest that the Rockefellers have across Latin America, and originally, you know, early on in Mexico and sort of in Venezuela. So it is that kind of conjunction of economic interest that actually brings this project of expanding or connections, establishing connections to Latin America. But also, I think it's also because of the Rockefellers' sort of insistence in the project that MoMA becomes an American, in this case, a U.S. institution, right? That the project is to create a modern culture for and in the United States, and that any notion of cultural dependency with Europe, in this case, should be sort of reduced. And this kind of project to create an American institution that services the United States and the culture of the United States is completely intertwined, right, with the political relations and economic relations that the Rockefellers, but also this country has with sort of Latin America. So in that case, for example, Latin America is kind of brought into the fold immediately because of the historic relations between the United States and, you know, and the South, if you will. So that kind of starts to kind of connect the dots. For example, I'll give you a very clear example. For example, Abby Aldrich Rockefeller was not only involved with MoMA, but also involving Colonial Williamsburg. And in one of the archival letters that I found, you know, she's kind of writing, I forget exactly who, to actually find colonial objects from Mexico so they actually can put in Colonial Williamsburg. So there's already this kind of geo-imaginary, right, of particular members of the Rockefeller family that are very much thinking that it's not only the United States, it's a greater United States, if you will, one that certainly encompasses Mexico. So absolutely, that we see with the presence of Diego Rivera immediately in the Museum of Modern Art, you know, as, you know, one of the most important living artists of the time. So that is, that kind of greater geography is always sort of playing up and emerges at MoMA, but it's always also contested by many, right? Many that are actually arguing for a European lineage of art, or certainly of modern architecture, and in this case, architecture was always on the back end, if you will, because, you know, there was on the people who were leading the charge in architecture, which is basically Philip Johnson. He had no interest, certainly in the beginning, in Latin America, right? He was all gung-ho, if you will, really wanting to bring a German filiation of modern architecture. He bring the filiation of Mies van der Rohe, if you will, to the United States. So for him, Latin America was this kind of, you know, backwards place that he had kind of no interest in. Although very early on, it's actually quite fascinating, he has to contend with people in Mexico and in Brazil actually competing with him to bring, for example, some exhibitions from Europe. So it's not that he was, you know, completely on the unknown. He had to have dealings with architects and cultural entrepreneurs in the Americas, but he certainly was, you know, not one to celebrate those geographies, if you will, at this particular moment in time.
And I think it bears mentioning that Philip Johnson, who obviously went on to have an illustrious career as an architect, was the first director of the architecture department at the Museum of Modern Art, which he financed with family money. And he was, of course, a fascist sympathizer, eventually leaving MoMA to work for Governor Huey P. Long of Louisiana, and radio demagogue and priest Father Charles Coughlin. And as you write, he celebrated a kind of Eurocentric, even Nazi modernism against the kind of modernism that you have described in this program, of the kind that Diego Rivera, someone who was on the opposite end of the political spectrum from him, explored in his own work.
So absolutely, and this has been sort of an aspect of Johnson's sort of life that was kept secret for a long time, but it has come back to haunt him and to haunt MoMA, correctly so, because I think it's an important sort of aspect of the history. You know, what is interesting about Johnson, and who's a very, you know, very young cultural entrepreneur, let's call him, because he's not yet a curator, not yet an architect. You know, he's trying to form himself or try to construct himself at this moment in time as a avant-garde persona, right? As a curator, but also as a public persona who's engaging modern culture, not only in architecture, in high circles, but also, for example, in shelter journal. He's trying to sort of activate these kind of cultural spheres at the very elite, but also at a, you know, also the kind of middle highbrow sort of culture of journalism in shelter journal. So it's quite fascinating that this kind of self-construction, right? In this self-construction, he then exposes, right, his political views, which are full of contradictions and full of paradoxes, right? But nonetheless, it is very clear that he is a philo-Nazi, right? He's very much fascinated by the sense of order that has been produced under the Nazis at the time, right? And he is taken sort of by this. But this is also sort of fomented by other characters in this kind of play of developing a modern culture in the United States. And one of these characters, which I find her incredibly fascinating because I think she's far more sophisticated than Philip Johnson, to tell the truth, is Helen Appleton Reed, all right, who is also very interested in what is happening in Mexico. So what we're starting to see at this moment in time is that this notion of cultural rebirth during a particular time of, you know, a very chaotic time, a time of extremes, it becomes very seductive to many people. And Appleton Reed, what's fascinating about her is that she's not only taken by what is happening culturally in Germany, but also what is happening culturally in Mexico. So she actually is able to connect these two kind of hyper-nationalisms. And we do tend to forget, right, that because of the political stripes, if you will, of Rivera, one tends to sort of forget that Mexico's national project is a hyper-nationalist project also, and that Rivera participates in this hyper-nationalist kind of project. That, of course, is really different from the hyper-nationalist and genocidal project of Germany. But if we start looking more deeply into Mexican biopolitics at the time, we will see, you know, that there are some very problematic aspects to it, but nonetheless. So what I find it fascinating is that it is precisely at this moment in time when Johnson is crafting his own persona, right, that he has these kind of philo-fascist tendency, more than tendencies. I mean, he is a fascist, and he's a Nazi. How far he would take his Nazism, well, you know, that is for us to sort of continue to discover, and Rivera is there at MoMA at the same time, that we have these two characters that are proposing two distinct different worldviews, but also two distinct views of what American culture should be, that come together in this really, really small exhibition on this new space that is created at MoMA, which is called the Architecture Room, right? So, and because of different conditions, the work of Diego Rivera, which is the murals, which what he's famous for, which are reproduced in color for the first time, are staged in a room that has the markings of a modernist kind of European room, and they're kind of staged together. And it's Philip Johnson who has to do this. There's no smoking gun of why he had to do it. To tell the truth, I didn't find anything. Oh, this is, you know, you have, no one said you have to do this. La la la. No, sadly. But just by going to the archive and going to the photographic evidence that is left, because there's also very little. There's very little in relation to sort of letters or whatnot that I start to tease out actually how he then manages to stage, you know, these two worlds, this, you know, Mexican mestizo modernity, and his implications of a, you know, a universal modernity in a space that is very much a la Miss Van der Rohe with some other furnishings by French furnishing, by Le Corbusier and Charlotte Perriand and Jeanneret, right, into this attempt to create this kind of universal modernity, which is nothing but a white modernism, right? But it's also quite fascinating. This actually, and this kind of racialization is actually picked up by the shelter journals in the United States. So you find that this conversation about race is actually happening in the pages of journals. This was a racialized moment, a cultural moment. So each one of these moves, again, we must reground them in this kind of historical moments when race and gender and politics very, very, very much present, right? And that when these ideas and concepts kind of dissolved or disappear, and better than dissolve, when they disappear later on, it is because a particular cultural construct, right, has won the day.
And for further discussion of those many threads, you can find more in Constructing Latin America, Architecture, Politics, and Race at the Museum of Modern Art, published by Yale University Press. Patricio Del Real, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sasha, for the invitation. I very much appreciate it.
Patricio Del Real is Associate Professor of History of Art and Architecture at Harvard, and he himself worked for the Department of Architecture and Design at the Museum of Modern Art. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.